23. Language as an instrument of production. Everything, surely, had been done to ensure his immortality. But to Stalin it seemed that his contemporaries, though they called him wisest of the wise, were less ecstatic in their praise than he deserved. Their enthusiasm was superficial. They had not appreciated the full depth of his genius. Of late he had been nagged by the thought that, in addition to winning the Third World War, he ought also to perform some great scientific feat, make his own brilliant contribution to a branch of learning other than history and philosophy. He could, of course, make such a contribution to biology, but he had entrusted work in that area to that honest and energetic man of the people, Lysenko. In any case, Stalin found mathematics or perhaps even physics more alluring. All the Founding Fathers had fearlessly tried their strength in those sciences. He could not help envying Engels when he read his bold ratiocinations on zero or on the square of minus one. Stalin was equally enthralled by the resolute way in which Lenin had plunged into the thickets of physics and left neither hide nor hair of the scientists, proving that matter could not be converted into any form of energy. He himself, though, however often he paged through Kiselyov's algebra or Sokolov's physics for upper forms, found them uninspiring. But just recently a happy inspiration, though in quite another field, that of philology, had been fortuitously provided by Professor Chikobava of Tiflis. Stalin vaguely remembered Chikobava, as he remembered all Georgians of any importance. He had frequented the house of the younger Ignatoshvili, the Tiflis lawyer, a Menshevik, and was himself the sort of awkward customer by now inconceivable except in Georgia. Having reached an age and a level of scepticism at which a man begins to care little for the things of this world, Chikobava, in his wisdom, had written what appeared to be a heretical anti-Marxist article, arguing that language was certainly not superstructural, and that there were no such things as bourgeois and proletarian languages, but only national languages. And he had dared to attack academician Ma himself by name. Both Chikobava and Ma were Georgians, so the response came in a Georgian university bulletin, a dingy, unbound copy of which, in ligatured Georgian script, now lay before Stalin. Several Marxist-Maoist philologists had assailed the impudent creature with accusations, after which all that remained for him was to await the MGB's knock in the night. It had already been hinted that Chikobava was an agent of American imperialism. Nothing could have saved him if Stalin had not picked up the receiver and let him live. He let Chikobava live, but decided to write an imperishable exposition of his homely provincial thoughts, perfected by a genius. True, he would have caused more of a stir by refuting the reactionary theory of relativity, say, or wave mechanics. But affairs of state left him simply no time for that. Philology, after all, was next door to grammar, and grammar had always seemed to Stalin a near neighbour of mathematics in point of difficulty. It could be written vividly, eloquently. He was already sitting and writing. Take the language of any one of the Soviet nationalities. Russian, Ukrainian, Belarusian, Uzbek, Kazakh, Georgian, Armenian, Estonian, Latvian, Lithuanian, Moldavian, Tatar, Azerbaijani, Bashkir, Turkmen. Damn! As time went by, it got more and more difficult for him to stop once he started listing things. Why stop, anyway? The reader would get the point more readily and wouldn't feel like arguing. It is obvious to everybody that... And then say whatever was so obvious. What, though, was it? The economy was the base social phenomena, the superstructure. And, as always in Marxism, there was no third possibility. Stalin, however, had learned from experience that you couldn't manage without a third possibility. There were, after all, neutral countries, to be finished off piecemeal later on, and neutral parties, not in our country, of course. In Lenin's time, if you'd said, "Who is not with us is not necessarily against us," or something of that sort, you would have been expelled from the party that very minute. Well, that was the dialectic for you. It was the same here. Stalin had pondered over Chikobava's article, struck by a thought that had never occurred to him before. If language is superstructural, why does it not change from one social epoch to another? If it is not superstructural, what is it? Part of the base? Of the mode of production? Strictly speaking, the mode of production consisted of forces of production and relations of production. To call language a relation of production was probably wrong. So, was language a force of production? The forces of production were tools, materials, and people. And although people used language, language was not people. It was a hell of a problem. A blind alley, if ever there was one. The most honest thing to do would be to recognize language as an instrument of production, like, say, machine tools, railways, the mails, and, of course, telecommunications. Lenin had said it. Without the mails, there can be no socialism. Nor, obviously, without language. But come straight out with the thesis that language is an instrument of production, and the giggling would begin. Not here at home, of course. There was no one he could consult about it. It could, of course, be put cautiously, something like this. In this respect, language, which is essentially distinct from the superstructure, does not differ from the instruments of production, from, say, machines, which are as indifferent to class as is language. Indifferent to class. Another thing you wouldn't have said earlier on. He wrote a period, folded his hands behind his head, yawned, and stretched. He hadn't done very much thinking, but he was tired already. Stalin rose and began walking about his study. He went over to a small window, which had two thicknesses of transparent, yellowish, bulletproof glass, with a shield of compressed air between them. The windows looked out on a little walled garden, where the gardener puttered about under surveillance during the morning, and no one else appeared at any hour of day or night. Beyond the unbreakable glass, mist hovered in the garden. The country, the earth, the universe were alike invisible. In these night hours, when there was not a sound to be heard, not a human being in sight, Stalin could not be sure that his country existed at all. He had travelled south several times since the war and seen nothing but one great, dead-looking, empty space. No sign of a living Russia, although he had journeyed thousands of kilometres overland. He did not trust planes. If he went by car, an empty highway unrolled before him, with an unpopulated zone beside it. If he went by train, the stations were lifeless, and at each stop only his retinue and very carefully vetted railway men, most probably security police, walked along the platform. He was beginning to feel that he was alone not only in his villa at Kuntsevo, but in Russia as a whole, that the whole of Russia was a figment. Extraordinary that foreigners believed in its existence. Luckily, though, this lifeless expanse regularly supplied the state with grain, vegetables, milk, coal, iron, all in the prescribed quantities and at the prescribed time. The same empty space provided excellent soldiers. Stalin had never set eyes on these divisions, but to judge by the cities they took, which he hadn't seen either, they undoubtedly existed. Stalin felt so lonely because he had no one to try out his thoughts on, no one to measure himself against. Still, half the universe was there in his breast, all order and clarity. Only the other half, what was called objective reality, was lost in the swirling mist that covered the world. From where he now was, in his fortress-like, heavily guarded night study, Stalin had no fear at all of that other half. He felt that he had the power to twist it into any shape he liked. It was only when he had to step into objective reality on his own two legs, when, for instance, he had to attend a banquet in the Hall of Columns, where he had to cross on his own two legs the space between car and door, then on his own two legs go up a staircase, cross a much too spacious foyer, and see the guests standing to either side of him, thrilled, respectful, but far too numerous. That was when Stalin felt wretched, and didn't even know what to do with his hands, which had long ceased to be of use for self-defense. He would fold them on his belly and smile. The guests thought that the Omnipotent One was smiling to be nice to them, but he was really smiling in embarrassment, Space, he himself had called, the fundamental condition of the existence of matter. But, having mastered 1/6 of the world's dry space, he had begun to fear it. The good thing about his night study was that there was no space. Stalin closed the metal shutter and stomped back to his desk. He swallowed a tablet and sat down again. He had been unlucky all his life, but he must keep working. Posterity would appreciate him. How had it come about, this Arakcheyev regime in philology? Nobody dared say a word against Mao. Strange people. Timid people. You spend your life teaching them the meaning of democracy. You chew it up for them, put it in their mouths, and they spit it out. He had to do it all himself, yet again. In a fit of inspiration, he wrote a few sentences. The superstructure is created by the base precisely in order to... Language is created precisely in order to... In his eagerness to get the words down, he hung his ashen face with its big, burrowing nose low over the paper. The wretched Lafargue, who also fancied himself a theorist, spoke of the abrupt linguistic revolution in the years 1789 to 1794. Had he checked with his father-in-law? Revolution? What revolution? The language spoken before was French, and French it remained. It was time to put a stop to all this idle talk of revolutions. Comrades obsessed with explosions should note that the law of qualitative change by way of explosion is not only inapplicable to the evolution of language, but rarely applicable to other social phenomena. Stalin leaned back and read over what he had written. It looked pretty good. Agitators must elucidate this passage with particular care, making it clear that at a certain stage revolutions come to an end and things develop only in an evolutionary way. It might even be that quantity no longer passes into quality. But that could wait till another time. Really? No, it was still too soon to say that. Stalin crossed out, rarely, and wrote, not always. Think of a neat little example. We have progressed from the bourgeois individual peasant order, a new term that, and a good one, to the socialist collective farm. He used a period, as anybody else would, thought a bit, and added, order. This was the style he favoured. Drive the nail home, then hit it again. If he repeated all the words, every sentence seemed somehow more easily understandable. His pen raced on. However, this overturn was accomplished not by means of an explosion, that is to say, not by overthrowing the existing regime. This was a passage which the agitators must explain with particular care. And the creation of a new one. No one must even think of that. Because of Lenin's superficiality, Soviet historians recognized only revolution from below and regarded revolution from above as imperfect, freakish, bad form. But the time had come to call things by their proper names. We succeeded in this because it was a revolution from above, an overturn accomplished on the initiative of the existing regime. Stop. That didn't look right. It suggested that the peasants had not taken the initiative in collectivizing. Stalin leaned back in his chair, yawned, and suddenly forgot entirely what he had just been thinking. The investigative zeal that had flared up a little while ago flickered out. Bent double, tripping over the long skirts of his dressing gown, the ruler of half the world shuffled through a second narrow door flush with the wall, into the narrow labyrinth again, and on to a narrow, windowless bedroom with concrete walls. He lay down, groaning, and tried to cheer himself with the thought that while neither Napoleon nor Hitler had been able to take Britain, because they each had an enemy on the continent, he would have none. He would sweep straight from the Elbe to the Channel. France would crumble like wormy timber. The French communists would help. He would take the Pyrenees in his stride. Blitzkrieg, of course, was a gamble. But there was no alternative to a lightning strike. We can start as soon as we have made enough atomic bombs and purged the home front thoroughly. He snuggled into his pillow and tried to collect his wandering thoughts. We shall need a blitzkrieg in Korea, too. With our tanks, artillery, and air force, We may manage without world revolution. In fact, the simplest route to world communism was via a third world war. First, unify the whole world, then establish communism. Otherwise, there were too many complications. No need for any more revolutions. We'll put revolution behind us. Not a single revolution ahead. He sank into sleep.